Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to the Alan Buttle Radio Show. This is episode number 5. And in this episode, I'd like to talk a bit about the Jewish influence over the Chinese system as it is today, and the personal experiences of mine that I've had while I've been in China for the last few weeks. And that that is why I haven't been producing these weekly podcasts up until now. I was going to make a podcast last week, but I realized there's so much to fit in to a talk about China that I wanted to give myself an extra week to do further research and get plenty of information packed into the talk. So, I've been looking recently at the Jewish involvement in the Chinese Communist Party and the predecessors to the Chinese Communist Party, and I find that in certain Jewish publications they like to actually boast about the Jewish involvement in various political struggles all over the world, and they'll make a point of highlighting the Jewish involvement. And with the Chinese situation, it's no different really, because I found an article in this magazine called Forward, which is a Jewish magazine, and there was an article in there on July the 9th, 2012, which is entitled "A Jew in Mao's China," and this was an article basically to promote Sidney Rittenberg's autobiographical film called The Revolutionary. And this article reads: "Until I saw the documentary The Revolutionary at the Philadelphia Independent Film Festival, I mistakenly thought that China, during the revolutionary period, was one country that had not felt the Jewish embrace. In fact, 85 to 90% of the foreigners helping the Chinese at the time of the communist takeover were Jewish. This included the daughter of the founder of the brokerage firm Goldman Sachs, who left the comfort of her Park Avenue home to assist the Chinese. The Revolutionary tells the story of southern-born Sidney Rittenberg, the only American that has ever been admitted to the Chinese Communist Party. The Mandarin-speaking Rittenberg, who was initially sent to China by the US Army at the time of Japan's surrender at the end of World War II, became an influential advisor to Mao Zedong and to the first premier of the People's Republic of China, Zhou Enlai. His pivotal role at the Broadcast Authority, explaining the Chinese communist point of view to America, earned him a higher salary than Chairman Mao." So they're not secret about the Jewish involvement in the Chinese system from the very beginning. And Sidney Rittenberg's a character that is very interesting. Now, he obviously is Jewish, came from the United States and ended up in China. And he became very, very closely connected to Mao Zedong and became one of his top advisors before apparently being thrown into prison and kept in solitary confinement for several years on two separate occasions. Now, I think there's plenty of room for skepticism about these imprisonments, and there's several of these very prominent Jewish figures that were involved in Mao Zedong were supposed to have been thrown in prison at certain points in complete isolation, but I actually question these accounts, because the way that people like Sidney Rittenberg and Israel Epstein talk about their prison experience, it just doesn't ring true to me as that they were really there, because I believe that if you're spending, you know, 5+ years in solitary confinement in a Chinese prison, I believe you'd be quite shaken up by it and not be able to just refer to these times, you know, glibly and without much emotion. But anyway, so I would warn against necessarily believing their prison stories, which they're quite keen to always talk about. But Sidney Rittenberg, he was released from prison and rehabilitated into the Chinese system, and he ended up becoming or starting his own consultancy business, which had clients including some of the biggest brands in the world, like Intel, Levi Strauss, Microsoft, Hughes Aircraft, and Teledesic, as well as having clients, individual clients, including Billy Graham and Mike Wallace. Billy Graham being the supposedly Christian evangelist, but that's another story. But the article did make a mention of the a woman called Jane Hodes. Now, Jane, we didn't actually mention Jane Hodes by name, but it mentioned a member of the Goldman Sachs family. And it's this woman, and she just took a little bit of finding, because there's very, very little easily accessible information on these characters. But I did find an article in, I think it's, the website was called People's Republic. It's a communist, communist web publication. And this reads as follows: Jane E. Hodes, H-O-D-E-S. A long-time Communist Party member, an activist for peace, social and economic justice, died June 6th at the Oakland, California retirement home where she had lived for many years. She was 90 years old. Hodes was among a number of young people born into privileged families in the early 20th century who dedicated their lives to the struggle for world peace and a more just, humane, economic and social system. Born August 25th, 1918, in New York City, Hodes was the daughter of Walter E. Sachs, who headed the investment banking firm Goldman Sachs, and Emily Naam Sachs, whose short stories and novels depicting the efforts of early 20th century women to forge independent identities were widely published at the time, and who later achieved success as a painter. Walter Sachs was a founder of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Coloured People, its first treasurer and chair of its finance committee. So basically, this this woman, born Jane Sachs and married Robert Hodes, who was a psychiatrist in the United States, they went over to China after her husband was fired from his professorship at Tulane University, and there's information on that as well. There was a purge on communists within the economic system at the time, and Robert Hodes was someone that absolutely denied his connections to China, and he had nothing to do with anything to do with China. And as soon as he was sacked, he went to spend 5 years in China. And her, Jane Hodes and her husband Robert Hodes, they basically ran an open house for people who for internationalists and communists to come to China and agitate for the communist cause. So they were very pivotal in the sort of in the efforts towards towards communism in the in China, with Mao very closely connected to them as well. So we have Goldman Sachs connections. We also have connections to the International Monetary Fund, because there was a guy called Frank Coe, C-O-E. Now, he was basically a guy who was very well connected into the United States system. He was a government official who was a member of sort of a communist party in the United States. He was basically like a spy, and on Wikipedia it says he belonged to a Soviet spy group known as the Silver Master Ring. Well, he also worked for the International Monetary Fund, and he subsequently went over to China to help people like Anna Louise Strong and Israel Epstein and Rui Ali. And this Frank Coe was actually a member of the Chinese English team that was employed to translate volume 4 of Mao's selected works. And of these 14 people, 14 translators, five of them were foreign, and all five foreigners were Jewish. And these were Michael Shapiro, Israel Epstein, Sidney Rittenberg, who we mentioned earlier, Solomon Adler, and Frank Coe. And yeah, I mentioned that he was also very well connected with a woman called Anna Louise Strong. Now, she was an interesting character, and according to some articles, she's actually she could be related to Morris Strong, who was a big name in the United Nations and things until recently, and it was certainly figure that they could well be related. But she was an author, and she was an active communist that was heavily involved in China at the time, alongside these other people. And looking at all these little groups seem to be interconnected to me. So we have these groups that are connected amongst themselves, but also connected to certain members of the Chinese establishment, which included people like Sun Yat-sen and his widow, his third wife and widow, a woman called Song Qingling, who was pivotal in connecting these groups and pushing for the communist revolution. Now, Anna Louise Strong and Rui Ali, that's R-E-W-I, Ali, A-L-L-E-Y, they were classified as permanent guests of the Peace Committee, and they were basically full-time promoters of New China. So they were employed for this, and after attending the Asia and Pacific Rim Peace Conference in 1952, Ali became a sort of international peace-worthy, to use British communist non-Greens words. Just reading that from an excerpt from an article, but he was also a key figure in organising for communism. This very strange and, I have to say, sort of deeply unsettling character. I've watched a couple of documentaries with him featured, and he's just the most creepy and unsettling character. But from 1927 onwards, he set up a political study group, or what he called a political study group, and this was a Marxist group, and it included Rui Ali, but also a number of other foreigners, almost all Jews, but of course we don't know exactly how many of the supposedly non-Jews were actually Jews. But this group included Rui Ali, George Hatem, Ruth Weiss, Maud Russell, Lily Haas, Cora Deng, Angus Smedley, Talitha Gerlach, Alec Kamplin, Trudy Rosenberg, Heinz Schipper, Irene Wiedermeyer, Cao Liang, and Deng Yuzi. And this study group actually met at Rui Ali's house most of the time that it met. And they had to sort of evade the nationalist police and things at the time to operate. And I've read another article that suggested that people like Maud Russell and I believe it might have been Ruth Weiss were involved in the smuggling of medicines and medical equipment into China for the benefit of the Communist Party, and Rui Ali was actually involved in the movement of guns around for the benefit of the communists. I briefly mentioned a woman called Song Qingling, Sun Yat-sen's third wife and widow, and she was very well. There was another prominent Jew who was connecting the Sun Yat-sen family, if you like, to the rest of the Jewish community, and that was a guy called Moshe Cohen, or Morris Two Gun Cohen, and he was a very strange character who came from London. He was a sort of small-time criminal Jew on the streets of London, and he found his way into China, and he became a quite major weapons dealer, and he worked alongside Sun Yat-sen, and he even became Sun Yat-sen's bodyguard for quite a time, and he was apparently devastated at Sun Yat-sen's death, but he would still work with his widow and connected a lot of these other characters as well. So basically we have these interconnected networks of people who were all working towards the same agenda. We have a guy called Edgar Snow. Now, Edgar Snow was a Western journalist, and he ended up writing one of the most important and well-read books on Mao in the West. And this book was called Red Star Over China. And it was written, as a way of promoting Mao, and and it was complementary to the communist regime, and this guy Edgar Snow was actually introduced to Mao Zedong by Rui Ali, the aforementioned creepy New Zealand citizen, who lived in China eventually for about 60 years, but. Also, Edgar Snow became closely connected to a guy called Israel Epstein. And Israel Epstein was another of these so-called translators and linguists that were employed at the heart of the Mao party to be involved in the foreign language press or the propaganda, basically, to control the propaganda. So, I mean, other people involved in the foreign language press were people like Sidney Shapiro, who was another Jewish agitator. And Sidney Shapiro ended up acting in lots of the Chinese movies, and he always played the horrible capitalist American. You know, as a communist Jew, he would be using his sort of Western appearance to get them to hate Americans. And Sidney Rittenberg was also in this group. I've just found this article. Talitha Gerlach, who is another communist that came to work with Rui Ali, she was smuggling money, medicine and medical equipment into China, while Ali was moving guns between different parts of the Shanghai communist undergrounds, and they were sheltering fleeing party members who were fleeing from nationalist police. And he and Alec Camplin, who I mentioned is also part of this group, they operated a covert radio connecting the communist underground with the Red Army. So there was all these connections happening, and there was, you know, there's a very, very long list of Jews that were very close to the Mao regime. And, you know, it actually has made for a very interesting area of study. There have been several books written on the subject, although they're kind of quite difficult to... because this area has been very neglected in sort of Western academia. It's quite hard to find out the details of some of these characters, probably not least because of the online censorship, and they've, you know, been actively trying to remove information on certain characters. You know, for example, they certainly don't want people finding out about the Goldman Sachs connection to Mao Zedong, for example. So it was actually very difficult to find any information about Jane Hodes, for example. But there have been a couple of books written on the subject which seem like they might be quite useful, by authors Anne Marie Brady, that's A-N-N-E hyphen Marie Brady, and Beverly Hooper, who have written books particularly about the foreigners who were involved in Mao Zedong's reign. And yeah, and I think I've got a list of about 100 different people who are involved in various at various stages and you know, in kind of in various ways to help the Mao Zedong reign. But we need to put this in the perspective of the massively powerful Jewish influence in China already, even at the turn of the 20th century, because you know, Jews have been around in China for a very long time, and these sort of certain big Sephardic Jewish families had been set up in Shanghai and other major cities of China for many years. And these families included the Sassoons, obviously from the who made huge money in the Opium Wars, for example, and families like the Kadoris, the Hardoons, Ezras, Nissims, Abrahams, and Gubeis, who were all major families operating in Shanghai and at the time and throughout China. And these families obviously had an effect on Chinese rulership, and I think it's clear from the stance of Sun Yat-sen on the Zionist movement that there was significant influence by these families over the leader of China at that time. Now, Sun Yat-sen, he is thought of today as the sort of spiritual father of the current Chinese state, possibly even more so than Mao Zedong, although Mao Zedong is seen as the revolutionary that that sort of got it all done. But Sun Yat-sen is sort of nearly as admired and as remembered as Mao Zedong in China, and you'll see countless buildings named after him, museums, hospitals, government buildings, whatever, named after Sun Yat-sen. So he's a very prominent figure even today in China as a sort of spiritual leader and an icon to look up to. Now, Sun Yat-sen wrote a public letter applauding the signing of the Balfour Declaration, for example. And he wrote this letter to a guy called Ezra. Now, his name is N-E-B. His initials are N-E-B Ezra. And I'll just find what that stands for. It stands for Nissim Elias Benjamin Ezra. But he was commonly just known as N-E-B Ezra. And he was part of an Iraqi Jewish family, Sephardic family, who were very prominent in Shanghai at the time, and obviously well connected to the other Jewish, major Jewish families. The Sassoons, by the way, were also commonly referred to as the Rothschilds of the East, to give you some sort of idea about, you know, the scope of their power and influence. But on the subject of the Balfour Declaration and the support of it by Sun Yat-sen, this was given as a letter to this N.E.B. Ezra, who had already set up the Shanghai Zionist Association. And this association obviously existed to promote Zionism to the Jews of the Jews of China at the time, and obviously to exert influence over the Chinese rulers, to get sort of international support for this movement. And a newspaper was founded by N.E.B. Ezra called Israel's Messenger, and this was set up in 1904 as the official mouthpiece for the Shanghai Zionist Association. So this association was directly funded by Sir Eli Kaduri, who was part of the Kaduri family. So we already have back then, significant influence over the Chinese rulership, in order so that so that the Zionist, you know, the Zionist movement would be supported right from the very top in the Chinese system by this supposedly spiritual father of the Chinese state. And yeah, and as I mentioned before, Sun Yat-sen's widow, Song Qingling, went on to carry on promoting communism after the death of her husband. And I found this book, which basically lists a huge number of Jews who were involved, and all of them require their own research, really. And I've only just started to scratch the surface of this, and I think it's a really interesting area of study. But it at first seemed like it was going to be quite difficult to piece all these pieces together, but with a little bit of determination and you know, following traces of links and evidence and trying to, you know, see if looking up one name can lead to other names that you can then look up and see and how they all connect in and things like this. But I've got a large list of names who were involved, probably about 100 names of people who have from various backgrounds that have come into China as Jews, of course, to affect the Chinese Revolution. And a lot of these so-called foreign experts were kept, were kept around, and their job was to, their job was supposedly to make sure that the Chinese system was well promoted in the West. But it probably is likely that these people were actually there to make sure that Mao did what they want, and make sure things, went along the right track as far as the international bankers who are really behind all this push, sort of what they were, so things happened the way they wanted them to, which is always the way it works, because money, of course, talks, even in a communist society. But so I think there's lots of very interesting information to be looked at, and I mentioned those authors, Anne Marie Brady and Beverly Hooper, who have written books that seem to me a little bit sort of critical, or at least objective, about the foreign involvement in China. But it wasn't just, obviously, a lot of these Jewish characters have written their own books about their experiences in China, and of course, you're not going to be particularly surprised by what they've got to say or what they've not got to say. But I believe that those authors might have something a little bit more valuable to say as they're trying to put these pieces of evidence together. And this Anne Marie Brady, she actually wrote a book challenging the character of Rui Ali and whether he was in fact a hero and whether he was in fact a good guy. So she's willing to actually speak out against these characters, because Rui Ali, apparently, and I'd never heard of him before, but he is apparently quite well known in New Zealand as a sort of a hero of the people and this kind of thing. And so, yeah, to write a book, questioning that legacy is really important. And in fact, Anne Marie Brady, she works from the University of Canterbury in New Zealand, and her home and offices were burgled, and the burglars didn't take any of the valuable, supposedly valuable things like money, jewellery, anything like this. What they did was they took her old laptop, they took her study aids, they took her papers and things like this. So there was clearly a well, you know, if we believe the story as how it is, and this burglary actually happened and things like this, they were there to disrupt whatever effort she was making, you know, towards her next work or whatever, because she's written several books on China and she's a fluent Chinese speaker, and yeah, I think that her most recent talk is quite interesting, and it gets to the bottom of, you know, what the current Chinese leadership, Xi Jinping, is doing in China. But I'll just talk about spend a bit of time talking about my own experiences of China, which were very interesting, because I'd never gone to a place like China before, and I don't think there probably isn't anywhere quite like it. But yeah, I'll just spend the next few minutes talking about my experience of China and how that sort of fits in with a world view and my analysis of how global politics is shaping up. Well, I was very interested by one particular difference between China and England, is how different communists behave in China as in England. Sort of the way communism is promoted in England, it's alongside other very destructive agendas, like, for example, feminism, promoting homosexuality and transgenderism. It's done alongside sort of anti-racism, anti-nationalism, and these kind of thing. But communism in China is actually promoted alongside patriotism, alongside family values, modesty, kind of etiquette, good behavior, alongside pride in your race and your people. So it's very, very different. And in China, you know, there's very little sort of sexual degeneracy, very little highly sexualized adverts or television or anything like this. People are not exposed to sort of pornography and things the way that the people in the West are. So I found that a very interesting difference, and people in China are quite modestly dressed. They, you know, they're quite shy. They're quite, you know, they carry themselves with a certain dignity that we sort of in the West associate with an old age sort of thing, with days gone by. But they have this sort of dignity and modesty and things. And although lots of aspects of the current Chinese system are have taken a lot from the West, like clothing and things, they tend to have only take the part of our clothing, for example, that is also in accordance with their ideas of decency and modesty. They believe in queuing. They don't push in. They don't, you know, antagonize you in the street. They don't argue in public. They don't get drunk in public. You know, so there's lots of actually quite, you know, there's lots of things to kind of admire about the Chinese people. And their behaviour as far as individuals go. But the whole, you know, the whole way that it's set up, I believe, is, I mean, they don't really know what's going on, I don't think. They don't really know who's really pulling the strings and what this communist regime is all about. Maybe they're just too afraid to talk about it and too, you know, because there are serious consequences for, you know, being against the Communist Party. You know, in China, for example, you know, well, we don't know the exact number of people that are executed in China every year, but I think estimates have been made at sort of nearly 3,000 people per year being executed in China. And this is about sort of eight times or six times the next highest, which is Iran. And so they are, you know, they do believe in power by coercion and by fear. And this is how they keep their public in check. Other things about the way that the Chinese system is set up is they spend a huge amount of money on security. So on almost every street corner, there's a box with sort of an elevated sort of little room sort of thing with police in or army in or other kind of security in. And huge amounts of money are spent at the train stations and the metro stations and things, because whenever you go into a metro station in China, you have to have your bag scanned, you have to go through a body scanner. They get this, you know, rod, and they swipe it over you to make sure you haven't got anything, sort of thing. And it all seems so unnecessary because in general the place seems extremely safe. But typical of communist states, they have extremely, you know, disproportionate amount of money being spent on security. And yeah, this is obviously all because, you know, all to keep people in line and sort of arbitrarily have people doing work, you know. But most of this work's absolutely pointless, you know, standing watching traffic all day, you know, or literally having nothing to do all day for most of these security people. But just the fact that they're employed and they're able to survive, sort of thing, based on their pointless employment, is how they often work, isn't it? But at one stage, not even that long ago, and I learnt this from Anne-Marie Brady in one of her speeches, that about 97% of the Chinese people were actually employed by the state itself. And this wasn't even that long ago, maybe one or two generations ago. But nowadays, of course, there's it's quite different, and lots of people are able to start their own companies. Lots of foreign companies have come in to start their businesses in China, and that's got a lot freer, sort of thing. So on the face of it, you know, like when you look at Chinese cities, they look just like cities in the West in a way. There's, you know, big corporations everywhere. You know, you don't see any great distinction between them. A lot of the banks that operate out of actual China are state-owned banks, so that is one difference. But who are these state-owned banks actually owned by? Well, we probably know, don't we, who they're really owned by? They're probably owned by the Rothschilds of the East, or even the Rothschilds of the West, and that these banks are just to sort of monopolize all banking within that country. But a couple of sort of a couple of other aspects that need to be discussed are obviously the Chinese state control of the flows of information within the country, because this is arguably the most important aspect of a communist system, is to control the information. And so obviously we know with the Chinese internet censorship that you can't access Google, you can't access Facebook, you can't access most of the Western mainstream media, you can't even download episodes of the Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show in China because it's forbidden. But you can go to the web page, but you can't actually download episodes. So obviously, with you know, as China's become technologically much more advanced, they're able to get a tighter and tighter control of the flow of information into and out of the country. So, so they basically have a population that has been educated only by the Chinese state, or at least only through information that's been approved by the Chinese state. And, you know, so to have an entire population of 1.4 billion people, nearly a quarter of the world's people, having a completely different concept of what's going on in the world than everyone else, and this country having the largest standing army in the world, the largest active military in the world. And I saw on, I looked up the statistics for the amount of military that the Chinese have, and they have over 2.1 million active military personnel at the moment, and obviously increasingly technologically advanced military as well. So this, I think this is a very important and concerning thing about China as sort of we're going forward, and obviously with the it has to be looked at in the context of the Belt and Road Initiative, or the One Belt One Road, which is a new sort of what they're building is sort of globalism too, which will basically see China take the center stage as the global producer for the world, and to create trade routes going from China to the rest of the world in order to supply the world with Chinese products. And this all fits in very, very nicely with the sort of ongoing deindustrialization of the West and the collapsing of Western civilizations, as is happening thanks to mass immigration into the West and the inevitable civil conflict that will come about as a result of that. We have the Western banks being deliberately brought to a near collapse situation, and that will happen when these rulers want it to happen. But bearing in mind what the what I mentioned with the in the Corbyn podcast and in the Assad and Russia podcasts, is that the international jury have been deliberately wrecking the reputation of Western countries to the international world, and this is to facilitate future actions against the West that will occur as a result of, like, the United Nations, for example, or whatever. Now, the United Nations are, or the United Nathans, as I as I like to say, they have. If you notice their stances on things like Palestine, you could be forgiven for thinking that they're actually, you know, not completely controlled by the Jewish banking elite, but the reality is that they actually are, and it's the West plus Israel that is having its reputation deliberately destroyed by the international jury, and this has got to be with some plan in mind. And with China sitting there with over 2 million active military personnel, completely conditioned to hate the West, hate capitalism, you know, they could easily, be employed by the United Nations to liberate the West into communism, or, into globalism, into international rule by the UN. So this is something we've got to really worry about, because, you know, in the West, we don't seem to care that, you know, the West is getting dragged through the mud constantly, you know. And obviously a lot of it is justified, but it's not the Western people that are causing the problem here. It's the Jewish control over our systems, which allow our militaries to be used for their own, you know, political agendas. And the biggest political agenda they've got is to destroy our own reputation, I would suggest, and to build up other people's reputations, like, for example, Assad, China and Russia. So we all have to be particularly concerned about this state of affairs. China are also part of this group that I've found. It's called the Non-Aligned Movement. Now, you probably haven't heard of this, and I hadn't heard of it until very recently. The Non-Aligned Movement, or NAM, is a group of states that are not formally aligned with or against any major power bloc. And this Non-Aligned Movement includes basically all of the non-white world, the whole of Africa, whole of South America, and the vast majority of Asia, and this includes China. China is one of the observer countries of this non-aligned movement, and you know, these countries are, you know, obviously they're all part of the United Nations as well, but they're going to be the ones, you know. And so this, just to give a bit of background, this non-aligned movement was set up by a communist Yugoslav president, Josip Broz Tito, who was himself I think he was at once supported by Stalin, but then I think they fell out or something, but nevertheless, this was a communist president, and we know where communism comes from, don't we? And sort of this movement started in 1961, and you know, we've got China also in the BRICS financial alliance as well. The Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa bloc, to take over financial control away from the West as well. And you know, when you look at, you know, oh, who cares if the West loses you know, financial dominance? Well, it's not, I mean, sure, because we don't, you know, the West isn't in power as it is. But what we're looking at is a gradual replacement of the West as the major financial and industrial centre of the Jewry, because most of their powers come through the power of the West in the last century, sort of thing, or more. But now they have, you know, they've taken such a control of the West that they can afford to collapse the West in order to bring the West into the kind of communism that they've already achieved in China, in Russia, and I will say Russia, because I do think Russia, although it appears to be, you know, the Soviet wall was supposed to have fallen, the Soviet Union was supposed to have fallen, is that not just a tactical way of restructuring and pushing for the global communism, which was always the point, wasn't it? It was always a global movement towards global communism. So I think all, you know, most of the Arab world is under the is under communist or socialist rule, sort of thing. You know, it's only the West that they have to have yet to completely communize. And you know, I think this is where we're heading. The West is not gonna, you know, the West is being set up to be destroyed, and this is it's something we've got, you know, we've got to get our heads around. And and the mass immigration policies into the West, into Canada, into the United States, into Australia, into Britain, and into the rest of Europe, that is a deliberate attempt. It's a deliberate part of a genocidal agenda taking place. So yeah, I think there's plenty to be concerned about regarding China, and I think there's you know, there's lots and lots of reason for serious concern with that. I mean, what we can really do about it, I don't know. All we can do is inform our fellow you know, white people, you know, European people throughout the world, as to what our situation really is, and we can try and, you know, think about taking precautions against what what's coming. But yeah, it's hard to it's hard to be particularly positive about this state of affairs, you know, when, you know, I do find it quite funny that, you know, Alex Jones, you know, has been targeting China. Oh, it's the Chinese communists sort of thing. Well, and obviously, you know, it's we can take the mickey out of him, you know, by saying, you know, look at all these Hollywood, you know, look at all the Hollywood producers and stuff. Oh, they're all Chinese communists, aren't they? And look at all these people that run the banks, they're all Chinese communists. And look at all these people that run our media stations, yeah, they're Chinese communists. And look at all these people that run the you know, all these political groups, you know, they're Chinese communists. Well, clearly they're not actually Chinese communists, they're ethnic Jews, aren't they, people, you know. But still, you know, the Chinese communist system is arguably where the Jews have most of their power, because they have 1.4 billion people who, you know, have been subjected to a complete information monopoly, and they've been subjected to the most you know, restrictive laws and regulations, like, for example, the one child policy that until 2 or 3 years ago, I believe, was still in practice, and now people are allowed 2 children in China. But yeah, it's you know, there's plenty to be concerned about with the Chinese regime, and the fact that, you know, look at the mainstream media in the West. You know, we understand that this is Jewish controlled, don't we? The media is Jewish controlled. You know, we can just look at the people running it, and, you know, things to find that out. Well, look at the amount of criticism there is of Israel in the current Western mass media. Compare that to the current amount of criticism of China. You know, China, they seem to be able to do whatever the hell they want in the international world. You know, the I was trying to find statistics about executions that I mentioned earlier. China, they're not being put under any pressure to actually inform the United Nations or whatever as to what their exact figures of number of executions they're performing are. They don't seem to have to, you know, they seem completely exempt from criticism and international pressure. Why are they allowed to not publish their their statistics like everyone else is? Why are they so protected from criticism? We're seeing upwards of maybe 2,000, 3,000 people being executed every year. When do we ever hear about it in the Western media? When do we ever hear about the ongoing oppression of the Falun Gong practitioners, or the what's happening with the Uyghur situation? It's very difficult to actually verify any of the information coming out of China, because there's a big language barrier a lot of the time, and there's also there's very few people in the West that speak Chinese that are actually wanting to do the right thing. I heard about them having slave labor camps for Uyghur Chinese Muslims, and they're treated appallingly. And then of course you've got the Chinese social credit system that's coming in, the Sesame Credit. And if you haven't discovered about this, then this is something which you really need to look up. It's a state-run credit score system which basically attributes you a number of points, and this point score can be affected positively or negatively by basically everything that you do, everything that you post on social media, everything that you buy in the shops, the friendships that you have, all this kind of thing that affects your credit score. And this credit score actually has serious real life implications, like not having a high enough credit score can forbid you from traveling on the high speed railway. It can forbid you from buying a plane ticket. It can forbid you from being able to rent a house. There's all sorts of real life effects that that having a low credit score will get you. I saw an interview with this Chinese journalist who had, apparently, I think he had like 4 million followers on the Chinese social media before his account was taken down. And he was actually, as an investigative journalist, he was investigating several murders within China, and actually was able to expose very, good information and to the audience. But he found himself with such a low credit score that he basically couldn't afford to, he wasn't able to buy a plane ticket, wasn't able to buy a train ticket, so he basically became a prisoner in his own home. The communists don't have any respect for freedom of speech, any respect for the uniqueness of every person. The Chinese communists, they promote this idea that the nail that sticks out gets hammered down. So the idea isn't to stick out, isn't to do something, unique and brilliant and individual to yourself, but just fit into the system and work for the benefit of China and of the Communist Party. So it's a very, very different way of thinking. And that's reflected in people's behaviour and everything as well. And obviously there are sort of good and bad manifestations of this desire to fit in. But ultimately, it's a poisonous ideology, and it's ruling through fear and intimidation. I think there's a lot of evidence to point to this being just another, another territory of the global Jewish empire run by their, by their billionaires, by their banking elite and their industrial elite. I hope I've been able to explore these areas to your interest, and I hope there's been plenty of things that you can go off and research for yourselves. You know, like these incredible characters that have come over to assist in the revolutionary process in China. And there's a documentary called Round Eyes in the Middle Kingdom. That's Round Eyes in the Middle Kingdom, and that is a very interesting documentary about Israel Epstein, and it's a Jewish made documentary by a Jewish guy that was born in China, and explains how it was to be a foreigner in China, and they're basically completely segregated from the Chinese community, and live, you know, lavishly, you know, while Chinese people are starving, you know, at the gates of their gated communities. And that was a real eye opener. But there's lots of that's one particularly to look out for, and I'll include links in the description to this episode, and maybe I'll do another episode on China at some point. But I hope in the meantime that there's been plenty of information to interest you and to whet your appetite to learn more about China as well. But thank you very much for joining me today, and I'll hopefully be back next Saturday with another episode on something or other. I'll try and figure it out sometime soon. All right, have a lovely weekend, folks. Goodbye.